Yeah. So we're discussing why Legendre came up with least squares, because before that, what they used to do when they had 27 data points and three unknowns, you work out three betas, you would take them in chunks of three and solve them perfectly. So, but then you ended up with 9 alpha, beta hat, gamma hat answers. Right? And then you average them. People objected, some mathematicians objected. Why? Because that wasn't even reproducible. Why? Why would was there an element of arbitrariness of that? And they didn't even know how to work out standard errors for that. But it's like doing a meta-analysis, isn't it? It's like doing a meta-analysis at this point. You have 9 meta-analyses now. But why is there a certain element of arbitrariness in that?
Do they have to pick how you choose the equations?
Yeah, which three do you do? And in fact, if you're a good mathematician, you don't just automatically take the ones in the order they come. There's an optimum kind of one to do to get the best betas. Anyway, that was all arbitrary. So then, what was the big moment? The big moment was Legendre, who said, well, if I posit an equation with alpha, beta, and gamma with these three values, then I will get 27 errors. Right? If I posit a different triple, I'll get another set of errors. How should I rank my triples, alpha, beta, gamma triples? Let's make a criterion that's absolute, that we can understand and that everyone would agree to. I could take the sum of the absolute distances, the sum of the absolute errors. Right? Why not? You know, minimize the sum of the absolute errors. You know, find the beta hat, gamma hat, and alpha hat so that I could minimize those. Would you agree that that would be a reasonable thing to do? It would, yeah. But what's hard about it? Okay, so what else could you do instead of absolutes?
Let's not come with absolutes.
Yeah, it has problems. It has problems in mathematical. Yeah, there are kind of funny things going on if you draw the curve. Yeah, or even in one dimension. Yeah. So what instead?
Squares.
Use the squares. Minimize the sum of the squares of the errors. Right. Minimize the squared residuals, basically. Right? Yeah. And so now, why is that so nice? And why was that such a breakthrough?
It is actually quadratic, and
you're guaranteed. Well, it's unique for one, yeah, and so on. But what else about the algebra of it is nice? You can write down the how do you actually find the alpha, beta hat, and gamma hat? You're not going to do trial and error.
No.
What are you going to do? You're going to take the derivative of that sum of squares with respect to alpha, beta, and gamma, set the three of them to zero, and now you have three equations and three unknowns, right? And it's going to come out nice and clean. And what is it about the equations as well? The equations have a very nice, simple linear form that you can solve. It's an equation of three, you know, the matrix, and it's a 3x3 matrix and a 3x1 vector of betas, and you have your answer. So it's what we do with least squares today. So it gives you a one-pass analytic solution, closed-form solution. And that's Legendre. And I'll send you that as well, because it's absolute. It's in French. It's called the method or something. The word moindre carré is in it. Anyway, the least squares is in it. I don't think he gave standard errors for them, for the beta hats. That came later, I think. But anyway, it was a big breakthrough. Yeah. It turns out now that maximum likelihood under certain distributions, like the normal, is also minimizing least the sum of squares. So there's a agreement between the two. Anyway, so that's it. Yeah, but that was three equations and three unknowns. You were actually interested in the three alpha, beta, and gammas, right? Or five, or however many you want. It could go up to as many dimensions as you want, but that's the beginning of the linear model. That's 1800. the beginning of the word regression is, so that's what I'm saying here, Legendre did this, but it isn't the beginning of the word regression, even though it is the beginning of least squares. And then you come to this guy, Galton and Pearson, who entered in regression models. Why did they use the word regression? Because least squares and the linear model, I can explain to you, everyone would get that. Three equations are 27 equations and three unknowns. 24 of them are errors and three are used for the betas. But when we come to regression, why do we call it that? It makes zero sense today to call what we're doing regression. Zero sense. But what's the beginning of it? Regression.
Something because like you're having these observations and it might be an outlier, but if you measure it multiple times, it actually come closer to the mean. So like you're progressing onto the line. Like in a long enough time scale, those outliers will actually hit the line.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay. Yeah, the word regression comes from Darwin. And it doesn't, and it has to do with when things move from one generation to the next, right? But Darwin did not call it regression, he called it reversion. Reversion. And he gave the example of, let's say, we took all the people here whose parents were very tall. Let's just, and let's not worry about his father and mother, let's just talk about parents. If you have tall parents, what about the child? Let's say the parents are three standard deviations away from parents. In other words, they're very tall parents. So you were in a group of people where the parents are three standard deviations above parents. Where are you likely to be? Because height is fairly highly hereditary. So where are you likely to be? If your parents are three standard deviations above, are you likely to be three standard deviations above?
Like somewhere in that.
Huh?
Above? Like you'd be above average, not necessarily. Like
that's right. Would you be that far above?
No.
No, you wouldn't. And in fact, Galton found you'd only be two standard deviations above. So he found a coefficient of reversion from three down to two. That was our 4 to 3. I forget his number. I think it was 1/3 reduction. So it was 2/3 instead of 3/3. So that's the first, what do you call it, ever. First curve ever. Right? And it has the word, come on, what am I looking for? It has the word, what did I say? Regression. Yeah. So let's see, Galton. I have a poster here. Do you see poster? Yeah. Okay. That's the first regression. It's the second one. It's the first human regression. What Galton had done a couple of years before is he didn't use humans. He used sweet peas, just peas, the vegetable peas. And he bought the peas. He measured the parents. He planted them, had them planted all over England. Different people planted them for him. And then he gathered the daughters of the peas, the offspring of those peas that grew. And he measured them. And what he found was the exact same thing. If he took a pea that was way larger than a parent one, that was larger than average, the children were closer in to the mean than that. So you see the word here? Called the mid-parents. He had a clever way of combining the two parents into one. He kind of averaged them with a little bit of tricking. When they're shorter than mediocrity, the children tend to be taller than they. He means in standard deviation terms, although it's not a right? So it's a very strange thing because he has height in inches here, and who's being plotted on the x-axis and who's being plotted on the y. First of all, this is the line of 45 degree. The 45 degree line, it says, if your parents are 3 standard deviations above, the offspring of them will be 3 standard deviations above, right? So it's the line, the number of standard deviations in the offspring is equal to the number of standard deviations in the parent. Right? That's the 45 degree line. And he's now saying, I think he is getting, it's about a third that he's getting. So, but can you follow the orientation? What do you think is on the x-axis and what do you think is on the y-axis? Can you follow it?
Y-axis is height.
Huh? Y-axis is height.
Is it like standard deviation, like on the right side?
Well, I think he's basically saying, what's this axis? No, these are bins of people. These are bins of people.
Yeah, it's like, not quartiles, but like.
They're like chunks of parents, yeah. But they're parents, yeah. So it's sort of strange that he's done it this way, and it's hard to tell. But when you see, but in actual fact, I'll show you, he has, where, 9 data points there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He has about 600 or 800 people in the study. But he has reduced it to 9 means. So he's basically plotting y bar against x bar in 9 segments, or in nine of these. So that's what he's doing. His data are here. So you can see here with the data what he's doing. And now it becomes much clearer what's going on. So now on the y-axis, who do you have? The y-axis here, all of a sudden now on the y-axis you have the parents, don't you? You see that? Those are parents. And he has how many, and they're in bins. So he sorted the parents first into bins, and again instead of rather having raw data, he basically has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, whatever they are, like little bin widths, right? And then the children are across the x-axis, right? So these are the children of the short parents, right? There's their, you see, heights of the adult children. So he has them along here. So he's actually flipped his y and x-axis. The number of people. He has 200 families. He ignores the correlated data stuff and all that. He has 900 children. 900 children where he knows the child's height, the adult child's height, and the heights of the two parents. So he's treating it as 900 observations, ignoring that there could be two sisters and a brother in there. That doesn't matter. He's ignoring that. Come on, we'll give him that. So he's the first one. Yeah. So this is the first one. Yeah. So then what he actually plots on the graph is the mean of, he has these. So these then actually become the X's, if you like. These are the X's. The midpoint of this, where is it? Yeah, the midpoint of this is the X. So he's going to plot. He's going to plot the children over the median of the parents, or the middle of the parents, bin. Okay? So you take the middle of these as your x's, and where's your y?
Is that the median?
Yeah. These are the children's heights. You follow me? He doesn't repeat it, but he's going to put these, he's going to put this. You see, he has these exactly. This is the middle of the height, middle of the bin, isn't it? Height of the mid-parents in inches. It's the middle of the bin. Right? So that's your X, and this is the Y. So he has, and you see, how many, are there 9 there? Yeah, there's 9 Ys there. He didn't take the top one and the bottom one because there's too few children in it. So he took 9 medians for the children and plotted them against 9 means for the parents. So that's the 9 data points. Right? Why did he do medians? Why did he do medians? Because he didn't have a calculator. Well, he did, but it was a human calculator. He called it a human computer. It was much easier to work with medians were easier, and he had lots of symmetric distributions anyway, so mean and median were the same. And in fact, with this data, you can figure out where the median is here yourself. You don't need a calculator. You just look, where's the midpoint of these ones here? You just add up until you get halfway, and that's the median of the chip. So that's all he did. Yeah. So then he took those 9 y's, plotted them against the 9 x's, and they're over here. Right? And you see the 9 little circles now? Those are his 9 data points. And now, even though he knew, so he has a very simple linear regression. He doesn't have a Legendre situation where he has three betas to be worked out. He has only an intercept and he doesn't care about the intercept. He's only interested in the slope. So how do you think he fit those? Do you think he used least squares? He didn't seem to ever talk about Legendre and least squares at all. He was more interested in regression in this new biological sense of regression, of reversion, of things coming down. And according to Pearson, Galton never had said himself, but according to Pearson, he used the straight edge method. He used the straight edge method. What do you think that means?
The ruler.
And you just play around with the ruler until it kind of looks right. Yeah, that's what he did. And I think he liked the idea of getting 2/3. I think he didn't want 0.631 or something. He wanted 2/3. So I think he called it 2/3. God knows how he got it. We could work it out now how he got it, but yeah. So that's it. Yeah. Now I'm still confused. I was confused about 2 things. One is this one. How come if you have adult children here, and there's male and female, right? There's male and female. So if you were trying to now look at the slope of child on parent, and he's squished the 2 parents into one, how are you going to handle the fact that males and female offspring are much different? There's about a 5-inch difference in the males and the females.
I guess that was his way of scaling it.
Well, you've seen already what he did. What would you do today? What would you do today?
Keep them separate, I think.
You'd keep them separate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then adjust.
What?
Add
sex to the model. Exactly, exactly. Right? And then you get one slope for both. It's parallel lines. They'd be parallel lines. Yeah, that's it. That's what we do today. Yeah, exactly. And R, report 2 separate betas, one for the males and one for the females. That's unscientific in his mind because he thinks that there's one beta for both genders. It should have nothing to do with gender, so he wants one beta. Or one correlation, or one whatever he wants to call it. Yeah. So, he didn't have LM, add sex to the model. It's easy for us today, right? So, what if I said, if I knew that males were about 5 inches taller than females, what else could I do? Instead of adding sex to the model, or gender, add 5 inches to the girls. Add 5 inches to the girl, and then they would be unisex, right? You think he did that? I think he was a better scientist than that. We would do that today, because that's effectively, when you add it into the model, that's effectively what you're adding 5 inches or whatever, and adjusting them women to be men, right? Effectively. Galton didn't do that. What did you notice, Jesse?
They just multiplied. So he brought them by scale, I guess.
Instead of adding 5 inches to everybody, he scaled them by 8%. Okay. Why did he pick 8%?
Did he know? I would just find out the average difference.
What's the average male height and the average female? It's about 8% higher for males, so he scaled that.
Okay.
So it's actually really, really nice. Yeah. So for 100 years, this is the only data we had at the beginning of this for regression. So I wrote to Steven Stigler and I said, is that a good model? You know, wouldn't it be nice to find the raw data before? These are unisex data, you see? He has unisex offspring. He doesn't, and he's also squished the parents together. He also multiplied the mothers, by the way, by 1.08. So he took the mothers multiplied by 1.8, plus the father, and averaged those two. So it's like two unisex parents. And that's what he got. Yeah. And so then he... So here's what I said. Is that how we would do it today? I don't know. And then we now have the family data as well. I wanted to have the family data as well. So that's a separate issue. And by the way, where he got these, just so you know, where do you think he got these? He asked parents. He asked people to write down, you know, in his family albums that he sent. He gave prizes for families to send in their family albums. That's what he was interested in genetics and stuff like that. He's in college genetics, but yeah. So this man sent in something saying he was 5 foot. Is that him? That's the mother. There's another one for the father further over somewhere. Where's the father? Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So that's it. So that's it. So there's a lot of measurement error in those too, because they're it's like you, I asked you about your mother and father, you kind of had to guess a little bit, right? You didn't go and physically measure them. These are self-reported heights from even grandmothers and grandfathers, so it's pretty poor. So that's what he got. And but then the thing that he did that was really modern is he said, where did he say it? He was starting Biometrica. He gave £500 to Biometrica as well to get started, the journal. He gave £500 to the parents of these for these data, and he gave £500 to the University of London to start the first statistics department that Pearson started. So he was a benefactor. He had his father had money that he left him and so on. But look at this. This was he then, because he gave £500 to start Biometrica, he got invited to do a little editorial at the front of the first Biometrica issue ever. And look what he says. He would like people to put away their data and share it. Right? You can't get people to share data even today. So he was dreaming about it. But he said it would be nice if we could have sometimes go back on data, and I think we should... When we publish data, we should put away a good copy of the data somewhere so that somebody else could take it out later and rework it. Really, really, really nice. Yeah. And so then that's what we did. So actually we found his data then. Is this the beginning of it? So there's the book, yeah. So he put away his copy of the data. And this is how lucky you guys are. I went and visited this afterwards. I wasn't there at the beginning when we found this, but somebody found it for it. But the big problem back then, this is 1886, the big problem is that he had about 25 questions that he asked all the parents. So he had like 25 columns of data for everybody. But to do his analysis, he just took out what he needed. He didn't keep any other variables. He didn't have Excel. So he took everything out. And the first thing you notice he did is he made a table. He put all his data into one table, and once he had the table, all the analysis were done from the table. So he aggregated the data so he could work on one sheet of paper. And there was no such thing as a listing like you'd have today, or you know, your head and tail of the data set. There was none of that. So I don't know, unfortunately, what the corresponding answers were on the other questions for these people, because they're all aggregated. So he did everything one analysis at a time, which is really kind of frustrating. And when I went back to find other things about where these rich families, poor families, I could find, we found the families, but the problem was that he had promised the families and to be anonymous, and he gave him a token, and he just numbered the families in each analysis he did separately. So even though he copied all that he had out of the books into his own books, sent back the analysis, the albums, he never linked them, and so they can't be linked at all. So he was very early on data privacy and so on like that. Can you follow what he's doing, though? Can you follow what he's doing?
What is the censorship order?
Huh?
Like in the third column, it says something order of height.
Sons in order of height.
Sons in order of height. Okay.
Sons in order of height, which means what?
Sorted.
He's sorting them within, yeah. So from left to right is shortest to tallest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the daughter is the same. Yeah. And then, what do you notice about, and by the way, everything here has 60 inches to be added on to it. So that makes life a lot easier when you can do that. And then what do you see down the first two columns?
I guess in the first is just an ID number.
Oh, is this?
So the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are the family numbers now. There's 205 family numbers. So
it's sorted in father height?
They're sorted by father height. And then within father height, they're sorted by mother's height. So it's really quite good. And once he has that data set like that, the next thing done is he makes his table. Right? You now see why he put the father's height along this y-axis. It's because in his data set, the father's height and mother's height were sorted. So basically, all the ones going into that first vertical horizontal bin are basically maybe down to here. So all the kids in this bin would now be in the first row of his table. And so all he has to do now is line things up and get the median of all these kids. He has to multiply all these by 1.08. Right? He was smart enough that he didn't do that once, every time. He didn't take the calculator every time and multiply by 1.08. He decided if I had a 69, I'd multiply the 69 or the 9 by 1.08 and just be done with it. So he had a thing for converting. When he was doing the peas, he never measured the individual diameters of the peas. What did he do instead? Because there's a lot of measurement error in measuring the diameters of the peas. Right? They're small little things. What would be a smart thing? He was only interested in the mean diameter of a group of peas. So what do you do instead? He had a little thing. He had a little thing here, a little groove. He would put them into a groove and take these and put them together and use his ruler and take the total of them and divide it by a number. So he was really on top of things, this guy. Yeah, exactly. So that's that, yeah. And then the last one, I don't know, I guess I don't do the last one. Oh, the last page. So that's page one. So you have the tallest parent. Do you see a regression to the mean happening here already? So the mean here of these parents is... what's that, 24? 15 and 6, 21, that's about 10. And so you're seeing the median of these is less than that, yeah. So you're seeing already the reduction in that the tallest parents don't have kids just as tall as they. And then this is the last one, I think. These are the shortest parents are here. Oh, I'm not sure which page this is.
Do the breaks mean something?
Huh?
The breaks.
Where?
Or like one... space, 2, 3, 4, 5 space.
Oh, it's the sorting, I think, within the...
it's like the cut point out.
Yeah, yeah. Here, you mean?
It'd be like 2 kids.
Oh, here the breaks? I don't know what this difference... Why it's there?
It's like 9, then 10, then 11.
Oh, I guess.
Oh,
yeah.
It's
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he had a routine. Like, oh, yeah, it looks like he's breaking them as well for his own... Yeah, I mean, this guy's... Yeah, you talk about data visualization. So he made life easy for himself. So it was very easy for us to go back. The only problem is, do you see some funny things there?
Tall,
about 5'10", you know, whatever, deformed. You know, somebody couldn't be measured, so on like that, yeah. So there's a lot of measurement error here. Yeah. And in fact, there's a lot, because of that, he got a lot poorer correlations than Pearson got. Pearson repeated this years later. So here's the This is your model here, right? This is the parents and the children, right? The children are on the y-axis now on mine, right? So here are the girls and here are the boys, or men and women, right? There's two different ones. Which is which here? B and C. C is add 5 inches. That's your model. Okay? That's your model. The one on the right.
Yeah.
Right? So you just moved everybody up. His one scales them up. Right? Which do you like better? It actually makes very little difference to the analysis because the data are so rough and there's so much measurement error that I was hoping one model would be better than the other, but I can't prove it. You know, I like the 1.08 model much more. But there's not enough range in it. But what else did he do by multiplying? There was something he did that's actually more scientific and more statistically right than adding 5.
I guess let's say you're taller, adding 5 might be not usable, maybe you're really short.
Yeah. So that's it. But what happens with the standard deviations? In your model, what's the model? The model is your height is beta 1 times father and mother, whatever that is, 2/3 or whatever, plus 5 inches if you're a male. And what's the epsilon? It has a sigma on it, right? And the sigma is whatever it is, right? Is that sigma the same for men and women?
No,
in your model. In your model, it's a homoscedastic sigma, right? That's what we mean by regression, right? A homoscedastic model. Epsilon is just normal sigma squared, regardless of x, right? But what does his standard deviation do? His standard deviation in the girls will have now scaled up as well. So now he has unisex, so you know it's much better, right? So the standard deviation of the girls will now be. See, there'll be men now, and they'll be taller. So he's actually doing it right. But anyway, I knew that's what I should get, but there's not enough data there, and it's noisy to show that his is way better fit than the additive, you know, the brain additive. But it goes to show you that statistical models, as far as I understand, they're very approximate. And so when we teach linear regression, it's not a question of assumption. The assumptions are wrong. The homoscedastic model can't possibly be right. You instinctively just added 5, so that's like adding a jump for the girls, right, or the boys, right? You did that, but it's just statistics. But if somebody challenged you, you could say, I'll test to see if I have my homoscedastic. We know blinking well that it's not homoscedastic, right? It's like having cats and dogs. The standard deviation in cats is a lot smaller than the standard deviation in dogs. If you scale them up, you should scale them multiplicative. You can't just add 5 inches to a cat and make him a dog, right? They're going to be a lot more variable, right? So it's the same thing. So biologically, this homoscedastic thing makes zero sense. Just about everything we study, the standard deviation goes up with the mean, right? So, I mean, one way to get out of it is if you really think you like a common sigma is use log scale or something like that. But yeah, so everything we do is, yeah. But now, does it matter? That's the issue now, is does it matter? Does having the right sigma, different for men and women, matter? And I would say, no, I agree with you. For certain things, if all I'm interested in what's the slope, I don't honestly care. The standard error is very insensitive to whether it's a bigger sigma or a smaller sigma. But if I was doing growth curves, and these were growth curves, and X was time or age, and the babies are getting bigger, and now they're spreading out, which is again non-homoscedastic, right? Then what? You better have your standard deviations right. If you're going to tell people about the parents about the percentage of their children, you don't use the same sigma at age 2 months as 22 months. The sigma at 22 months has to be way bigger because that's biology, right? So you see what I mean? When things matter depends, right? For means, and standard errors and things, the basic things we do in EPI, I would say no. I don't even fuss. And yet you teach, you take a statistics course, we got to check the residuals, we got to check normality, we got to check homogasticity. It depends on what you're doing. The only time that I ever had to check homogasticity and all this other stuff was the time I was doing things with the drug testing, with the WADA thing, the World Doping one. Because there we were fitting percentiles. And I knew they'd jump on me if I didn't deal with the percentiles well. So we were actually, the variation was more important than the mean. So there it mattered. But we've got to be careful not to routinely, just blindly, because we have a machine, check the residuals, check this, check that. But and somehow I don't understand when I'm tracing it back and I hear students saying, I got to check normality of the exits, or I go, where the hell did you pick that up? I don't know where. The teachers swear they never said it. You should only check, if you're going to do anything, residuals after the exits have been taken out. And anyway, does it even matter? Probably not. Yeah. But somehow or other, these things are what people do because I think they're easy to do and you hear other people saying. Anyhow, that's all background to this. But to me, I think I'm going to send you this paper to read now that we've talked about it. So the Galton one was one. So there's the first one. And yeah, they're the first regression. And I'm saying the data are available here, so letting people do it. Yeah, Galton used a straight edge to fit a simple linear regression. Right? But today we can do more because we can now get at the raw data that we found and unwrapped, basically. We basically unwrapped, or unpacked, I guess is the word you'd say today. We unpacked those data from the table back out to the individuals. So these are the models we have now. Right? So, can you follow these? This table, can you follow what it is? Did you say you know your parents' height? You, who knows them? Who knows the parents' heights fairly well?
I know them.
You know them, okay. What's the average of them?
My father is one.
Oh, no, we don't need the average now because Galton averaged the parents. So now we're going to have separate ones, yeah? But these are in inches, by the way. You don't know them in inches. Yeah, so we're stuck. Okay. Unfortunately, these are in inches, yeah.
Well, I mean, we can convert them.
Okay, yeah. So we ended up doing them for fathers and sons, for sons and daughters separately, for reasons in a minute to do with Pearson. So can you follow now the four models for sons, say? So what's the first model, the first row? The very first row, 69.2. So what model is that? How do you think I got that? So that's height, tilde, height, model is height, it's LM, height of the pair, of the child, of the son, tilde what?
Tilde what?
Tilde one, tilde one. Mm-hmm. So this is, I call it the mother of all regressions. It's the mother of all regressions, the beginning of all regressions is tilde one, right? And that's 69. So these were actually fairly well. 69 for a son back in 1886, that's pretty good. It is much more than that today, I don't think. Is it? Now, what about this one? And what's this, by the way? This is the way Pearson put it in his paper. Galton didn't have a plus and minus, but Pearson in his data set did. What do you think the plus and minus? Do I say it here? Oh, standard deviation of the residual. Okay, so So when you fit a model, just the betas are one thing, but you should always give the sigma hat, if you want to talk about it. It's part of the model. I think we forget that too. Right? We forget the sigma. Yeah. So now, what's this? So if a father was 60 inches, what would that make the son, the average of son? It would be 0.45 times 60 plus this. Right?
About the 69.
Yeah, exactly. And then, what do you notice here now?
Oh, no.
it's going down, because now the father is explaining some of it, yeah? Then this one, okay, that's the mother, so, right? And now we have the double. So we have four models here, tilde 1, tilde 1 plus father, 1 plus mother, and 1 plus father plus mother. That's the three branches. And that's the best of them, obviously. By the way, why do you think this is worse than this?
They're still better than the law.
Huh?
They're still better than the Giuseppe. So
I know it is.
I don't think.
But why do you think that there's higher residuals when you only have mother in the model?
She's not accounting for as much of the variance.
Yeah, but why not?
Because they're different genders, or they're different sexes. So, like.
Mothers
are shorter.
Okay.
But if you look at other different plot to jump up.
Yeah, so you're all thinking of statistical reasons. There's a more basic reason. Did you look, remember that data set? Remember that graph you were looking at?
Yes, there are a lot of measurement errors for the model.
There's more measurement error in the model. It was men who filled out this book. Can you imagine men filling out a book about anybody? Right? Men hardly know the names of their children. Now they know their heights, right? The mother knows those things. Yeah, so there was a lot of measurement there. The mothers sometimes, when they were measured, Pearson said they were measured with the chiffon, whatever they call them, and the hair up, and whether their boots were on, all sorts of things. Yeah. So there's measurement there. That could be part of it. It could also be some what you said. Yeah. And then this one, okay. So the father, there's a better correlation. Actually, the way we can tell, there's a better correlation between the father and the son than the mother and the daughter. That tells you something. The correlation between father and son is 0.4. The correlation between mother and daughter is 0.3. So that's a very bad sign. Yeah. Pearson, that's 0.5. Pearson students, that's 0.5 for everybody. All combinations. Father, mother, father, son. Sorry, all the four combinations. But here it's quite sloppy. Now, first of all, why has this changed from 45 to 42? Or why has this one changed from 37 to 33? Yeah, if they were not correlated, remember when I asked you about the age of your father and mother or something like that? If they were not correlated, then you could keep going and just everything would just keep adding independent. And it wouldn't change the first. But as soon as there's a correlation here, but it's a pretty weak one, a weak correlation between father and son's height, that means that there's a small bit of shared. This is not just father. This is father plus a bit of mother. And this is mother plus a bit of father. And this is now trying to separate. These are the two equations linking the father and the mother and vice versa. And so I explain later on then how you actually get the difference. So that's Galton's one, which are pretty poor data. Pearson has much better. So there's the quality of the regressors, very poor in the case of the wind. And so you see what he says? Pearson talking about it later. High heels and all these, this is Victorian England at the time. Daughters would be more raised. Yeah, the daughters then would be probably better measured than the son, than the mothers as well. But still worse than the sons. Yeah. So that's a noise issue. So now here's the carefully measured data. And this one, this is what Pearson did. So Pearson was very different than Galton. Galton was a data guy, and he did his own data analysis. My impression from Pearson, and I've seen his lectures and in the archives, he'd come in, he'd give his lectures and so on. He'd let students do the work of generating data. When he was teaching probability, he would get the students to shuffle cards, and they'd have to mail him back the data for next week, and then he'd use it in the class. So when it came to this, he set out students to start measuring people. Because he wanted better data for his correlation. He was just inventing correlation at the time. But anyway, here's his... So he got the students to do family measurements much more seriously. So now we're going to actually measure them. We're not going to ask you what your parents' height is. We're going to ask you to measure them yourself, your brother, and your parents. So he insisted, and he said, I want three things. I want height, span of arm, and what's the third one? There's one other one. The length of the length forearm. Okay. So he said, this is how you do one, this is how you do the other, and this is how you measure this. This is the length of this. Yeah. So this is good science now. With a diagram. In fact, we're trying to work out how to do this today on the web. And our biggest problem, we can do all this and show all these and get you to do this. Would your parents do this? See, the point is you're not going to see them for a while. So it's not like Pearson's one, the students were living in London, they were living at home, they would get their parents and so on, they could go back. So they brought back cards like this. Right? So this is the data card that each student had to bring back. Right? So it was very easy. And one student looked after all the four people in the family, or five or whatever. He wanted a son and a daughter. Well, he wanted at least four in the family, two of each generation, something like that. And so on and so on. And he wanted to make sure also there were biological parents and all this sort of thing, not adopted and so on. And you see, he didn't want the recorder to be published or anything, but he needed some way of looking it up later. So there was an anonymity with a code and so on. So it was well done. Yeah, so that was an example. No, but he want. You know, all he did is he said, "I want to check, be able to check the data."
Yeah.
So it's good. We have that issue too, but our issue now is we're thinking very seriously of repeating. He gets about 1,000 pairs of families of this with very, very good data. We cannot find the raw data, but there's enough data in his paper to reconstruct all the things you need to basically be able to simulate. Our biggest problem, and I'm asking you guys as a little test. I've thought, we've made a little web page, it's very easy, we even have a slider where you just slide in your height, you know, we don't even type it, you just drag the slider along, it's a little shiny app, it's very easy. You can switch between centimeters and inches, so again, that's not an issue. The question is, would your parents use it? Would your parents, if we gave them a shiny app, they'd have to just, you'd have to email or call them and say, look, come on, we need your data. What do you think?
My parents do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would, yeah. If you're in this class, okay. Yeah. All right, once, two little extra angles. One is, they will fill it out on the web themselves. You'll fill out yours on the web, right? Do it all on the web. You have to go and get a ruler somewhere, or get somebody to measure you, right? How are we going to keep the four of you, how am I going to keep you and your parents together? See, here it was very easy because they were all on one sheet. So they were linked. How am I going to get you and your parents, because I definitely need you to know that you were in the same four. How am I going to do that? Technically.
How would I do that?
Like, yeah. So how would I do this? But let's say I'm starting with you, and then you're going to finish the job with your parents. Yeah?
If you give each person in this class a code, a pin or something, send it to us, and then
you can
you
give
just
it
have to type that, the parents just have to type that in.
So you would email them that and say, look, when you're filling it in, make sure you put this pin number?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not just make it in the Shiny app as like a, are you adding anyone else? Are you adding a family member? Yes. Then you sort of make this subset in the app.
But you do need to know who it is. Because, well, the other thing we were thinking about upstairs, and Sayer and I are working on it, is as the thing is being filled out, we want the thing to go into a file, right? So this would be building up. Now, you might get to yours today, and then your parents might get it tomorrow, so they'd be in between numbers and the thing. Yeah. But would your parents be okay with either a pin number from you, I guess, would be the easiest way, right? Or you could make your own family pin number, could you?
I feel all of them. Huh? I mean, I can feel all my parents. Why would they need to feel that?
Oh, well, no, that's the point now. You're not seeing your parents. I want you to physically, because we want the same kind of data. If you would just guess.
No, I mean, call them, measure this, measure that, and then tell me, and then I will.
Oh, I see, okay. That would be good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be easier?
Especially.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. We didn't think of that. Yeah. We were wanting to have it completely anonymous. So actually, it's much better if, yeah. Because they're only giving you the data back then, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, that would simplify life. Yeah, yeah. Because then it's like this.
Yeah.
And then you fill the whole thing in. Okay, one extra question. So we would use the exact same format as this, same instructions, same everything. We might as well repeat it, right? Because you can get a lot of information from this. One last thing. In London, there was no issue, because I think they were all white people, if you know what I mean. You know, middle class or upper class London people. So there was no ethnic variation whatsoever. You were going to get correlation just from ethnic groups, without anything else. You know that in genetics, right? That there's something, what's it called in genetics?
Population structure or stratification,
yeah. That even if you don't know what's going on, if there's subgroups there, it will induce correlation. Just think about it. Let's say some Asian populations that are shorter, they'll be, and taller ones. So even if there's no correlation between father and mother, within a country, between countries, there will be. You follow? You can have two circles of data, one here and one here. They can be independents within each, or no correlation, but they'll be well. So I think, unfortunately, and this is where it gets really sticky now, I think without that, the data wouldn't be worth much. Right? Because if you have short people, you don't know what you want, you need them connected. And I think you need to know something about the origin.
Will that affect it as much as like nutritional status? Like you might have more homogeneous nutritional status here now than, although I guess they would have all been middle class in England.
Yeah.
Like they would all, it's not like they got short, poor people.
No, they got quite rich people. Yeah, no, these are people whose sons and daughters, mainly sons and daughters, were going to University College London in 1890. Yeah, they're all well off. So that's, to me, the stickiest one, because two things. We'll have to go to McGill, first of all, to get permission to do this nowadays. Even as innocent as I think this is, people won't think it's innocent. Your parents are going to ask, are they going to share the data, you know, and so on and so on. And then how fancy should we get with... Oh, the other thing I think would be useful, especially if your parents are older... Your mother might be getting shorter already, right? And your father too. You see what I mean? So I would think your parents, at least if we say you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, 40s, whatever, that sort of thing probably wouldn't be bad. You could probably tell us that without any great detail. But how detailed would you get on country of origin or ethnic origin, whatever you want to call it? This is getting unfortunately very close to something Pearson was criticized for. Pearson today would be a racist. And Galton would be a racist today. And in fact, they're talking about in London taking Galton's name off the auditorium at UCL. Because he was such a racist. If you heard what he said about Jewish people, if you heard what about black people, if you heard what he said about others, he was, you know, he wanted to breed the British race. Yeah, so this is... So, even the word Galton and Pearson, to mention these in the same thing, a lot of people were already turned off when they hear this. Yeah. So, what would be sensible, what you're trying to capture is kind of short races and tall races. That's all I want.
You can have both, like country of origin race.
But what's race? I don't even understand what race is.
Like, in the standardized way that standardized surveys.
Oh yeah, there are standard ones.
General region, or like we could just do like, you know, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, like South Asia, Southeast Asia, like general regions, not like country. That might be.
Oh, I see, yeah. But would it get what you're after?
Yeah, I think that would be enough detail.
What about, are there big variations in height in China, for example? What's your impression in China? No?
I would say yes.
Huh? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I mean, I guess the first thing we'd want to know is do a survey of average heights in different countries. That's what we kind of want, right? We need to know what's the average height in different countries, and then kind of use that as our... Because that's what is going to create the false correlations. So we need to be able to do the correlations within countries so that you don't have false correlations if you do it across countries. Okay, anyway, we'll have to think about that. But I'm happy to hear that you'd be willing to do it for your parents as well, and it would be easier, right? Yeah, okay. Last thing, why do you think this was used? I didn't know why.
The forearm distance?
Yeah, but the left one in particular, yeah. It was actually a unit of measurement in a certain culture, biblically. In the Bible, there's mention of this. I didn't know it, but I found out that I'd seen the word in the Bible called cubit, C-U-B-I-T. Anybody of Jewish persuasion here? How Jewish are you? Would you know the Bible well enough?
I don't remember so much. I'm Jewish.
The word cubit,
yeah,
was used in old Jewish measurements. Cubit, and I didn't know what it meant. Like, you'd seen stuff about cubits high or something.
Was it about for making the portable temple, or...?
Was it? Maybe. But anyway, it has to do with this here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can...
Sorry, go ahead. How would you use that as a... Like, everyone would have different...
But everyone has different size foot as well. But I think they probably defined it as 18 inches or something like that.
Okay.
Like, you know, the foot was the foot of the king, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 12 inches, whatever. This was 18. You measured a horse. How do you measure horses? How high they are? Hands.
Oh, yeah.
Is how you measure. Yeah, so they were all kind of things. Old ways. Yeah, yeah, yeah. These were all old measures before we standardized. Yeah. Exactly. So this is a cubit. But I didn't catch it until later. So why?
Is there the name of the bone?
C-U-B-I-T, yeah, from here to here. Yeah. Yeah. You can look it up. Yeah. Anyway, that's that. Yeah. And then I'm just trying to finish now on this. So this is the carefully measured one. So now you have the same thing. Now look at the differences now. Do you remember the ones before? The correlations were...
pretty similar.
Right, but look at this, 0.45, 0.35. Yeah, but now they're gone way, these are gone up now, I think. Yeah, you see, they're up in the 50s now. And those are basically, they're, slope and correlation are the same thing if your x and y scales are the same. If your x and y scales are the same, you know, the same standard deviation, then correlation and slope are identical. Right? So correlation... A beta is just a scaled correlation, you know, with the sigma x and sigma y. Okay. So that's that, yeah. Anyhow. And now there's more on it, but anyway, that's the data. But we were able to reconstruct a lot of this. But now the last one I wanted to get to is the one where there are high correlations. So the correlation here between father and mother, did I give it? Yeah, 0.28. See? Correlation between father and mother is 0.28, almost 30. It was only 0.05 or 0.08 in the other one, and I think that's because of bad measurements, right? But here, are you surprised correlation of heights in parents is that high? I was a bit surprised. Because this Galton, you see, used the fact that the parents were almost uncorrelated in their heights. He liked that because it helped his math. But here now, it's clear that the correlation is not trivial. But are you surprised that it's as high as it is? Because Galton basically says, people do not mate on the basis of height. People don't mate on the basis of height. He was also checking whether they mate on the basis of temperament. Or people of the same temperament or the same eye color tend to mate. But he said, they don't seem to mate on height. And here, this is saying they do.
But like based on my friends that I know, they most of them like they will consider the high when they are considering
when they're made
or relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think so. Yeah, exactly. But you have to be careful with it because correlation is tricky here. Because if somebody says, well, men are taller than women generally, will that induce a correlation? No. A correlation says, will a taller than average man be with a taller than average female? But it's the average in the females, right? So it's each one is in relation to their own mean. So a lot of people told me, oh yeah, there has to be a correlation between men and women's parent, you know, between pairs. But it's not that. It's the if you look at the correlation, it's y minus y bar multiplied by x minus x bar.
Couldn't you have, like what you were talking about, if things were stratified and you had like two groups, one here and one, like one lower, one higher, and they're uncorrelated inside, you might still think that they were?
Yes, oh you can, Anyhow, yeah. So here's, so the last one now, so we're now moving to ones where there's a much stronger effect. So 0.3 is not a huge correlation, 0.1 is nothing. But here now we're talking about parental ages. And now correlation is 0.8 and 0.9 between the two. So now we're going to have a much harder time figuring out the contribution of one to the other. And the example I give first and then pass it over is the one of maternal and paternal ages with respect to Down syndrome. Right? And they were, for a long time, figuring out, is it the father's age that matters in Down syndrome or the mother's age that matters in Down syndrome for the frequency of it? And it's not that easy to figure it out because there's a high correlation between the two. But you have to do the regression, add the father first, then add the mother first, then add the father, and see which one is contributing first and the second one not. Yeah. So that, and the same thing between, what's the other one I said? There was also, for a long time, they didn't figure out Down syndrome in relation to birth order. People thought for a long time that it had related to whether you're first born or last born, or in the middle. And in fact, it has nothing to do with that. It's all about the mother's age. And of course, if you're last born, the mother is older. So a lot of tricky things. So these are very basic things, and they're still very good examples of confounding, if you want to call it that. And then the one that really I started talking about at the beginning is the de novo mutation. And this one now has the data in it. And so here now you see, here you have the father's and mother's ages and the number of mutations in the child. Right? And that's where we study that. And then here you can see very strong. Where is it now? There's the data set in two dimensions. So on the x-axis, you have presumably the mother's, the father's age, and on the y-axis, the mother's age. And then this is the number of mutations. So z, the y here is like the response is here, but you have it as a function of this and this. So can you see from there how many mutations per mother and age and per father? Well, again, if I only gave you this one, right? If I only had the father, it would be 2.1 per whatever. If I only have the mother, it's 1.9 per mother's age. So they look very close. So it looks about 2 for each one. But if you do both together, what is it? It's 1.8 times the father plus only 0.23 times the mother. So you can sort it out. And in fact, that t value of 0.7 and the p value of 0.49 is a mother added last contribution. And I think that's the one we should check it on, whether this is the same as doing the test sequentially. I think it has to. The proof of it is, when you do it sequentially, and you is it a partial F test? Isn't that how it's done?
Yeah, like a...
What you do as the mother, the father only, then the mother plus the father,
yeah.
And you look at the difference in something, and it's an F test.
Yeah, like the statistic would be.
It's an F, an F with one, and the degrees of freedom that's left over. Mm-hmm. But what's an F with 1 and 49 or 1,049 or whatever degrees of freedom? What's an F statistically for those statisticians? An F is a number between 0 and infinity. It's a positive quantity. Bigger is more significant. Well, what is an F compared to another distribution? I'm not expecting you to know, but I'm expecting his statisticians to know.
I think it's like a squared version of
A square of a what?
I think it's a test, but...
It's the square of a T. Yeah, F1 something is T something squared. So I think they have to be the same thing, because you're getting the T here. So if this is the T test, the other F test has to be the square of the T, I think. So anyway, this one, that's the data here, but this is an interesting one, and there's an interesting audio and so on in here as well on this one. But so here's what they published in the original paper in Science or Nature. This was, forget about the fact that there are different types of kids here. Those are three models they put. And so they had father's age of conception on the x-axis, and they just had number of de novo mutations on the y-axis, right? And it's pretty linear. And here is an example, now where you should see the, if you're doing this by regular regression, you should actually see the sigma spreading out. Why is that? Why should you see the sigma, the it fanning out going this way?
You're further from the center.
Yeah, but it might not be happening so much if it were heights of people, but here, this isn't their height, this is the number of mutations they have.
You have more mutations as you get older?
Yeah, which is clear, right? As the father gets older, yeah, there's more mutations.
The scale of the spread is also going to get larger?
Yeah. And what's the model you're likely to think of here?
Poisson.
Exactly, Poisson. This is about as Poisson as you can get. This is about as Poisson as you can get. Right? The mean should be 2 times your age, roughly. 2 times your age, right? So if the mean is 64, standard deviation, 8. Mm-hmm. Square root of the mean. This Poisson distribution has a sigma equals square root of the mean. So expected 64, sigma 8. Expected 25, sigma 5. You see? So it's spreading out. So it's a beautiful example for teaching of the Poisson distribution. And it'll fit, I'm sure. There's no extra Poisson variation here. So, but this is the only thing published. And I'll turn off. So we're going to discuss now the reanalysis of the Oscars data, and I'm going to ask people, first, if you have to explain immortal time to your friends who are not in epidemiology, how are you going to say it? And what nice example? This one is a bit complicated, and also it's not a clear-cut case, right? Because in the end, what did most of you find? That did winning make a difference or not?
No.
Not significantly anyway, right? No. Yeah. Did it look like the rate was lower in the winners than the nominees?
No, like the hazard rate.
Yeah. It was a little lower, right? Some people got almost equal, and I have to check what you guys did, because none of us found that before. We all found that the hazard ratio was 0.75 when we did it the wrong way. And about 0.80 something when you did it the right way. Or a right way. Right? Something like that. So I don't know, some of you got hazard ratios closer to 1, and I don't... Huh? Yeah, I don't know what... We'll have to look into it, see what happened. But in any case, so it's not a clear-cut case. But if you want clear-cut cases, what ones would you use for telling people? Because you want to explain to them what's wrong, What is it? Immortal time is a quick, short way of talking about it. But what's really at issue here? What's wrong with what they did? By the way, the statisticians in Denmark, that I'll come to in a minute, explained it on TV as saying you used in your regression model a variable from the future. Do you follow what they're saying? They use in the regression model a variable that you don't know at the beginning, that is only later in the future. Do you work with Sammy?
No.
Yeah, Robert?
Yeah.
Okay. Sammy has made a career out of doing it. Actually, it's Sammy, I think, that put the word immortal time out there for everybody. It was there in concept a long time ago. The word immortal time was thrown around in Harvard in the 1960s. But Sammy is the first one to put it in the title of a paper. And that's what gets it solidified. So the statisticians were trying to explain this to the Danish population on TV in a big scandal in Denmark where this went wrong. And I don't think they let the guy off. It was a clear case of it. And they didn't nail him. Because they said it's you have a covariate that's not determined yet. So you can't put into a regression in a prediction model or an etiological model something that is only going to happen later on. Right? When we talk about something going on in the future, we're using it based on what we know now. So how are you going to explain it to your friends what immortal time is? And your best example is usually with, or best way is usually with a good, sharp example. Yeah?
What if you talk about life expectancy of people who lived in an old folks' home versus people that didn't? Because,
yeah,
they had to live long enough to get into the old folks' home.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. When I asked Mietnin for an example, he said, why don't you talk to him about the life expectancy and its remaining life expectancy, too,
yeah.
We're talking about remaining life expectancy. That's another thing. Because remaining already means you're conditioning on some starting point, right? Yeah, so Mietnin says, why don't you talk about people that, retired people, the age of death of retired people is older than the age of death of non-retired people. So he's taking retired people who died and non-retired people who died, who will have older ages of death. They're retired, because again, for the same reason, you had to live long enough to be retired, so automatically that. Yeah, so that's another one, yeah. The big thing in it, you'll notice, is the way, I don't know if he didn't do it because he used the living and the dead, but a lot of people started doing this thing wrong at the beginning with average ages of death in two groups. That's a very dangerous thing to do. Whenever you have an average age of death in two groups, you're only looking at dead people. And that means the living and then the survival analysis off. And the most classic example of that is, for a different reason, is to do with left-handed baseball players and right-handed baseball players. So they were worried that the world is against left-handers. Anybody left-handed here? Okay, isn't the world against left-handers? Lots of things are complicated. Yeah, but even, look at this, even you have a chair that at least is left-handed.
Yeah.
So, That's it,
exactly. So that's an issue there. When you look at the average age of death of left-handed baseball players and right-handed baseball, you're missing something very important, and that's what's happened over the years as to the acceptance of left and right-handed. So you get funny things going on there. Yeah. But this thing where it depends on a station of getting to, like, the other one, Maitness, is why don't you lose the average age of death of full professors and assistant professors, right? If you classify them as whatever they were when they died, of course, that has something. You generally progress to full professor, so of course, you have to get through associate first to get to full, so that means it takes longer, so you can't die as a full professor at age 30, but you can die as a full as assistant professor at age 30. Right. Again, you're only looking at the dead people, so it's another example. William Farr, I'll send you the link to it. William Farr used a lovely example. He was the Registrar General at the time of the cholera in London, and he said the average age of bishops, the average age of death of bishops is longer than the average age of death of curates, of priests. Because the bishops are the more advanced ones with the higher rank, and the others are here, and then you move up the ranks. But an even better example, the average age of popes when they die is higher than the average age of priests when they die. Why is that? Get to be pope, you have to live to about 75 to even become thinking of a pope, right? Mostly, right? So there's a clear example that a condition for being a pope was living long enough to be the pope. Yeah, so that's probably enough of the examples, right? And so here the issue was to win, right? To die as a winner, you had to win first. So you had to go longer from now. You could possibly have to wait from maybe the first time you're nominated until you won. So you had to wait, right? But there was no condition, no waiting time condition for the nominees. You could die the next day, right? So the example we've gave in the paper, I think, was the one with two people. That's very easy to tell. If you look at Richard Burton, that was the guy who was married about five times to another person who was married about five times, Elizabeth Taylor. So he played in Cleopatra, he played in lots of Shakespearean movies. He was very, very good, a fantastic British actor, or Welsh actor. Had been nominated five times, but died of drink, basically, at age 59. Having been nominated four or five times by Hollywood, they didn't like him, though, they never gave him the prize. And yet, George Burns is a guy who was nominated at 80 and died at 100. Yeah, nominated and won at 80. He nominated and won the same year at age 80, lived to 100. So now you have a comparison between George Burns living to 100 and Richard Burton living to 59. Burton never even made it to 80 to be in the contest with Burns. So it was an unfair contest to begin with. He was already dead, so even in the contest could only have happened when both of them started at the same time. And I think that's what's missing in this analysis, is that they didn't start at the same time. And worse than that, they started at birth as well, which only complicates matters more. But, yeah. So the seems to me the contest would be, if you think of a randomized trial, you would randomize somebody to be nominated or to win at one or the other, and then you could follow them both from the same time. So that's the obvious starting time, if you were trying to do that. So what were the various ways you did? I saw one of two of you. One of you took the timeline of a person and said, if it changes from nominee to winner, I'm going to have to make two records of it. Is that what you did? You follow me? So one of you did that. Who did that? I didn't have time to look them up. But somebody said in their programming, they said they basically had a timeline in the Lexis diagram. It was like a if we're working in the Lexis diagram, which is useful anyway here, right? So we have somebody here, they were nominated here, and then they're going along, and if they were never anything else, then they go along until death or censure, right? But if they were nominated, and then won, and then this, right? So in this case, this could be one long record in the Cox model, right? So you have this thing called survival from T1 to T2, right? And then you have the censoring, whether it was exited by death or exited by, right? So this is the censoring one. Well, did they exit by death or exit by censoring? So one means they exited by death and the other that. Normally, when you do the survival one, you don't even have to put the T1 in, right? You normally put just T, survival, T, and the indicator. of dead or alive. Why is that? Because by default, they assume you're starting at time zero. Right? But time zero here, now we have to decide what time zero means. Right? Are you going to start the clock and start the clock at zero when they get nominated? Or are you just going to start the age when they got nominated? And some of you started the clock when they got nominated and called that time zero. And everything was, so this was like zero, and this would be 45 years, say, that you lived after being nominated. And this would be the same. But another way to do it is you could say this is age 43 and this is age 86. Right? So that can be the age of the start and the other. And I think it makes more sense here. Some of you did it by age and some of you did it by time, by calendar time. Which way did you guys do it?
We did both.
Okay. Did it? I don't think it changed much. Did
not by much.
No, no. But it's more, it could be there are other situations. Here, they're all healthy people. So age is hardly an issue. It's going to go up slowly, the death rate with age. But this could be sick people or other things as well, and there could be lots of other complications. And age might make more sense in some cases than others to model. Because when you match on, when you use age, you're basically using age to make the risk sense. And you don't have to model age. If you use zero here, and call it time since nomination, then age has to go into the model, and that's much harder to model. Right? So the point is that Cox says, model if you must, match first, model if you must. Match first on time, that's a tough one to model, on age, I mean. You can put time in the model, like calendar time. And that's not going to move as much, so even if you're wrong with the model, it's not so critical. So, anyway, if you had this one and you go from age 43 to 46 here in one shot, that's just one record in the pH model, or the Cox pH model. So it's one line of data. But here, basically what you have to do here is make two lines out of this. Two observations. You split their time, and while they were a nominee, so it went from 43 to 62, and then it went from 62 to 87 or whatever here. So you put this in as one record, and this in as the second record. And what you put here for the exit status? Censored. They obviously had to be, to get to the next one, they're censored. So this is 62 censored, and this 87, and then you start to 62 again here, and you go from there to 87, and this could be either censored or not. Yeah. So that's the by far the cleanest way.
Does that change the entry condition?
Hmm?
It's like the beginning of your study would be getting nominated, but then it's nominated or...
So, sorry, and then you have to change. Yeah, here you're just nominated the whole way through on this one. Here you're nominated for this period, and you're a winner for this. Mm-hmm. So you have to change the condition. I forgot that, the most important thing.
You have two records for one person.
Hmm?
You have two records for one.
That's right, So a bunch of you use that. Yeah, and I saw it in your code that you were basically... So it's very easy in your case. You take the record, you look to see if they were won or not. If they win, you split the record. If they're nominated, you need one record.
You could also have like a third group.
Oh yeah?
Like nominated is when it's like another exposure.
You mean they won at the same time? They assume.
No, I mean they like another type of event, not just winning and nominated, but nominated and winning could account for some sort of variation that just winning.
Oh, I see. Win immediately, you mean?
Yeah.
They won immediately. Oh, okay, that could be another group again, yeah. Winning immediately is a different thing, because here you don't know whether they won immediately or not, I see. But yeah, it could be a covariate, or it could be something. Or it could just be something about,
Waiting period.
Got you, yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, so the key is this. That's the main thing here, is that the idea of a split record. Any of you stated people? Nobody is a stated person? Yeah, stata has this thing about splitting records.
Yeah.
Where you can do it automatically. I don't know when...
You sent this data, Lance.
Did I?
Yeah, one of those in the previous...
Okay.
Previous class had a data
line. Oh, okay.
With the Poisson, like comparing the Poisson with the Cox.
Okay.
Model,
okay.
That you could split it sometime.
Yeah. I don't think OR has a way to automatically, because it sounds like in Stata, you can just say, there's an event here that will split the record on that. Yeah. But then all of them may have ways of dividing up the record into one-year pieces or the same lengths and making multiple. Because there's nothing special about doing this versus going 43 to 44, 44 to 45. You can put them, many of them, the same thing. They won't change anything because they can figure out in the end what it's doing. So you can split it more finely if you want. And the reason to split it more finely is if other things are changing. Right? Let's say they got married. Let's say they did something else. You know, or oral contraceptive use here in breast cancer. Every time you have a child, you'd have to change the record. So there could be several splits because you're having more things happening. Are you adding a new covariate that you're updating? See, here, if you do it, you can't update the covariate between here and here. But if you break it down smaller, you can. So basically, the whole buzzword here, the buzzword is time-dependent covariance, right? That's what we're talking about. It's a Cox model with time-dependent covariance, where you're basically splitting the record. Yeah. So the Lexis one does a good bit of the arithmetic for you, but you can do it yourself. One of the things I'm going to be... for last week's one, I took the Oscars data set, and I did it every way I could. So including Cox, but also Mantel, Hensel, and some of these other ways. Because when I showed you in the small data set, the toy data set, I asked you to do the log rank test. Think? Yeah. There, let me show you that. I have it here somewhere.
For the survivor?
Yeah, for the little baby one that we were doing, the toy example. You can sort of see that lots of things are coming together when you do that. So I said, let's take, we had this example here where there were only 20 timelines. And this is this is not Lexis diagram, but it's sort of Lexis diagram turned sideways a bit, isn't it? It's the same thing. You see the timelines here. Yeah, but if I do this, this is the timelines of these people, and I small n was nominated, and then you change to big N, no, you change to W, like here's somebody nominated, then they won later, and then they spent years as a winner, and then the capital W is when they died, or capital N. So here I was doing the risk sets, right? And so in the log rank test, you actually see it very clearly what's happening, and it's a real pain to do, as some of you, I saw the coding of it, yeah. But basically, you have to line up a little 2x2 table here, and I had no winner died, one nominee died, two winners were still living, and nine nominees were still living. So that's a 2x2, and then the log rank says, well, what would you expect in the upper right corner of this? Or upper left corner. Yeah. And so you have an expected value of what it would be, and then you add up all the expecteds and all the whatever, and I think somebody came out and told me that there's a difference between one and the observed and expected numbers. I did it the opposite way. I was looking expected winners dying, somebody else had winners surviving, so they had it flipped. But indeed, we agreed on that. Right? But separately from doing the test, which I don't find as interesting, if you want a ratio, or some kind of an odds ratio or a hazard ratio, you can actually do something like Mantel-Hensel straight from here as well. Right? Because Mantel-Hensel is exact, where did I put it? There's the Mantel-Hensel. Mantel-Hensel is the sum of AD over N and BC over N from the 2x2 tables. And this came out to just about the same hazard ratio as you got by the Cox model. But it basically shows you that all the action is in the risk set. All the action is in the risk set. By the way, why is there no, even though there's a death here, a nominee died, why is this not a legitimate or useful risk set here? This one. Why isn't this a useful risk set? There is a death. There's no comparison. Yeah. So when you have nobody in the comparison, it drops out as well. Yeah. So it doesn't contribute to that. But the beauty of the Mantel-Hensel is you see right away what's going on. AD over N will be zero if there's no death. BC over N will be zero the other way around, if it's flipped. Right? And so there's your ratio there. And in fact, when the Cox model was published, Mantell has a letter to them, or a discussion point in the discussion of the Cox paper, complaining that this thing, that the test that they came up with, the log rank test or whatever, is basically the Mantell-Hensel test, or something like that. Or he was complaining that he was being ignored, and he had done all of this thing. He had not done this for time. He had done it where these were separate strata in a case control study. But the logic is the same. This is like little mini case control studies inside of the survival analysis.
With unit times strata.
Huh?
With a unit times strata.
Yeah. Each time is its own little 2x2 table. Yeah. It's like you're doing a little mini case control study at every time. Yeah, exactly. So they're all very much linked to each other. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, I think that was the main thing. I'm going to look at them in detail now and see whatever, but I'm bothered that some people were getting... Most people could reproduce Rendle-Meyer's one. Most people, I think, reproduced the one we had, but a few of you did something else, so I'm trying to figure out why you were coming out completely on the null. Was it by Poisson regression or was it by Cox? But and they were both coming out to close, the hazard ratio is coming out close to 1? Or maybe there was something else. What did you have in the model? Gender?
Yes, sex and race.
And race. But maybe you had something else in the model.
No, actually, like, I remember in Poisson, like, I did it.
Yeah, but it may well be what other variables you put in there.
Yeah.
So in the notes also from last week, I'm going to show you also, if you look through them, in the Oscars one, I did the COPS model two ways. One way, when we were comparing male and female, you can put class, which class they were in, as a variable in the regression. But there's another way to do the COPS model, and the same here. You can do stratified COPS model. You know what that means? You've heard of stratified Cox model? The regular Cox model, when there's a risk set here, there's males and females together in the risk set. Right? In the same risk set, somebody dies, you're interested in the winner versus not winner, but there's some are male, some are female, some are young, some are old, right? So you have to use a model to convert males to females, effectively, like Galton with his 1.08. Right? So it's the same idea here. You're modeling, you're using a model to equalize the sex differences. Right? Another way to do it, and so the risk sets are big because they have men and women in the same risk set. Another way to do it is say, look, let's split the men and women right away. That means now the risk sets get split up. And then you have some risk sets that are male-only risk sets. But they'll still have winner versus nominee in them. That's the one of interest. And there are other risk sets that are female-only risk sets. Right? And then it's a 2x2. So it's like splitting your data rather than modeling the data. Right? And that's called stratified Cox. So you have to use, instead of putting sex, it's a bit like we did with the conditional logistic regression last week for the... to make sure you could tell who was in the same risk set. Remember, you would use as strata or something. Mm-hmm. Here you would use strata as sex or gender or whatever you have. And then it would basically say, the risk sets are smaller, and I will never compare a man with a woman using a model. I will have men versus men, women versus women. Right? Women winners versus winner nominees, men winners versus whatever. That's the cost. So that's an extra option as well. Yeah?
You have to...
Very easy to do.
You can only do that, like, if you don't want to model
yes.
sex. You, like, you
exactly.
Like
I mean, you have always this thing. I'm going to be giving a talk at the Jewish in a couple of months. I've given it a couple times last year. And my motto now is, match first, model if you must. You know, why would you stand up and argue about what we... It doesn't much matter for gender because it's a binary variable. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're modeling age versus matching on age. People will start arguing about modeling age. Oh, did you put it linear? Did you put a spline? Did you do this? If you match on age, nobody can argue it. You can stand up and talk to people about, look, I compared men with men, I compared women with women. I never tried to turn a man into a woman with a regression model.
But with like stratifying, it'll always have to be like a binary or a categorical.
Yes.
So like,
yeah. You can't do it so easily for continuous ones unless you make quintiles or something like that.
But then like categorical or binary might be a little easier model or less risky than age, or still, like, why would I want to avoid modeling sex, I guess?
Well, it's one less, because Galton had to say, I turn men into women into men by multiplying them all by 1.08. Some says, why not 1.07? Why not do something else? You know, why, how do you get that? So that's kind of the issue, right?
Like if you have the sample size to do it, then maybe you could.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It saves you a degree of freedom as well. It may lose, I mean, you may lose something because you may have run out of risk sets with it too, right? Yeah, that's a possibility. Anyway, I'll put this in the notes, but to me, regression, adjustment, is like a mathematical way of turning men into women or women into men, right? It's making people equal synthetically, and that's harder to defend in court. I would much rather in a court arguing with the lawyer, because the lawyer is going to find somebody to object to my model. That's what I'm saying. By the way, when I was talking with people about the Galton data, and they thought it was really neat that Galton multiplied the women by 1.08,